This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Last week, the Trump administration imposed sanctions on three foreign companies for selling prohibited goods to North Korea. And Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin says they won't be lifted until, quote, the final fully verified denuclearization of North Korea. A few days earlier, National Security Advisor John Bolton had complained about North Korean inaction on the issue.
We're not looking for rhetoric here. We're looking for performance of North Korea's own commitment made to us, made to South Korea beforehand, to denuclearize.
Are you suggesting North Korea is not living up to that commitment?
I'm suggesting President Trump has held the door open for them. They need to walk through it.
So, in a quick recap of recent history, Donald Trump elevated our nuclear fears by calling Kim Jong-un Little Rocket Man and threatening, quote, fire and fury like the world has never seen, then held a summit with Kim that he said pulled the world from the brink of annihilation.
And the president tweeted, after the long flight from Singapore, everybody can now feel much safer than the day I took office. He also added, there is no longer a nuclear threat from North Korea.
The Kim regime replied that the U.S. must first stand down and carried on developing its nuclear weapons and missile program. The standoff has been bizarre and frightening, a sort of real-life black comedy, which is precisely how it looks to Jeffrey Lewis. He's director of the East Asian Non-Proliferation Program at the Middlebury Institute of International Studies at Monterey and an expert on the nuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. Having spent most of the Trump administration being asked where all this could lead, he answers that question in a book titled The 2020 Commission Report on the North Korean Nuclear Attacks Against the United States, which is a novel.
We do a lot of work at my center where we try to explain what the North Koreans are thinking about nuclear weapons and how things might go wrong. And it turns out it's really hard to explain to people how a crazy outcome could actually happen logically. It's very hard to reason someone into an unreasonable outcome. It's much easier to show someone in a story how bad decisions and a bit of bad luck can go wrong.
The premise of the book is just that convergence of events. Routine U.S.-South Korean war games taking place near the Korean DMZ, a provocative U.S. PSYOPs strategy. A technical problem on a South Korean passenger plane. All of these resulting in the North Koreans shooting down that airliner and killing 200-some passengers, most of them teenagers. And then all hell breaks loose.
Yeah, so it's easy enough to imagine a serious crisis, but what really then has to happen is that crisis has to spin somehow out of control. And in the book, the way it spins out of control is leaders trying to make good decisions, but trying to make those good decisions with bad information and sometimes with really bad processes. So I don't, for example, paint President Trump as a malignant force who's trying to start a nuclear war. But all the people around him who are trying to manage up spend all their time managing him and not enough time actually managing the crisis that's spinning out of control.
It all comes off as ripped out of the headlines and just a little bit extrapolated. In other words, it all seems so real.
Well, yeah. One thing I wanted to do is just have real people do real things. And what happens is the context is different. There was a story that the staff struggles to explain the concept of time zones to President Trump. On a day-to-day basis, that's a bit of weird local color. But in the middle of an international crisis, those kinds of things suddenly get really dangerous. So I didn't force anyone to do anything that they don't already do. I just needed to curate the behaviors that we already see and then toss in a little bit of bad luck.
In the book, the crisis takes place right after Trump has just tweet-fired his entire national security team. There's kind of nobody minding the store.
Yeah. Early on, I made the decision to put President Trump down at Mar-a-Lago. I actually dug into the different practices for staffing the president when he's down there. Mar-a-Lago is a private club, and so the staff don't stay there. When you put all that stuff together, the way the president's being handled presents these really obvious plot points for things to go really wrong, for him to tweet when he shouldn't be, for him to get bad information that he shouldn't have, and just generally to be very disruptive.
Now, you said earlier that you don't portray the president in this book as behaving out of malice, but the Donald Trump you write about in this book is an erratic, vain, incurious imbecile, which is just one of many factors contributing to the catastrophe, but not a trivial one.
Even when you have less erratic presidents, there's a lot about our nuclear policy that's a little bit crazy. Trump helps illustrate why certain things, like, for example, giving a president sole authority to launch nuclear weapons without a second vote, maybe isn't the greatest idea.
Some of the risks you identify, it seems to me, reside in people's lack of understanding about North Korean mentality and its history of American nuclear doctrine, of our ability to intercept incoming missiles, and a whole host of other assumptions that many of us simply are getting wrong. What's the top of your list?
I think the big thing that we never quite think about is how our plans interact with their plans. You know, in the book, I describe three different war plans: North Korea's war plan, South Korea's war plan, and the U.S. war plan. And the U.S. war plan actually shares something in common with the other two, which is it totally depends on going first. The problem is, two of them are wrong about that. And I really worry that in a crisis, that could be incredibly escalatory, because I think military officials in all three countries will be pushing their president to get moving before the other side does.
To what extent is the press coverage culpable in our misunderstanding of the situation here?
One big problem is that the North Koreans are never really represented in our coverage. Our coverage is almost always a political horse race. It's Republicans versus Democrats. So the North Koreans are almost like extras in the story, which is not how they are in real life. And then I think the other thing, which is just a structural problem that is true for all reporting at the moment, is what do we do when the president lies? We have seen the Secretary of State and the President of the United States describe what was agreed to in Singapore in terms that are just plainly false. And I think it's very hard for reporters to just point out that North Korea has never offered to give up nuclear weapons. You know, instead it's always, well, the president says this and experts differ. That leaves open the idea that perhaps the falsehoods that the administration have presented are true, but then leads to this whiplash effect when it turns out North Korea is not giving up the bomb.
May I suggest a possible third area of concern? And that is the characterization of the North Korean regime as fundamentally irrational.
Yeah, I think that we have real trouble separating ruthlessness from irrationality. You know, a lot of the things that Kim Jong-un has done are terrible, right? Assassinating his half-brother or executing his uncle. But those are not instances where he's insane. Those are instances where he, with some reason, believes that there are people who want to push him from power. We don't do a good job of trying to understand how it might be rational in his mindset.
In the beginning of this conversation, I outlined some of the things that have taken place with respect to North Korea and how the two sides seem to be no closer to any kind of ongoing enforceable agreement. What do you think does happen from here?
Well, we're going to continue to see this gap. You know, the North Koreans are not offering to give up their nuclear weapons. What the North Koreans think is that their nuclear weapons have brought the United States to the table, and that if they're willing to entertain the aspiration that someday these weapons won't be needed, that then the United States will move to make relations better. The U.S. has the opposite idea, right? Give up the nuclear weapons first, and then we get better relations. That gap is not bridgeable, right? Someone has to change. And so I think for the foreseeable future, that gap will persist, and the Trump administration is going to try to paper over it. What I worry about is the day when it becomes clear that North Korea isn't giving up its nuclear weapons. What does the Trump administration do? The best option would be to admit that North Korea is not going to give up its nuclear weapons, admit that the threats of 2017 were counterproductive, be realistic, that we're going to have to learn to live at least for a while with North Korea's nuclear weapons, and then work on a totally different basis. That really does not sound like President Trump to me, right? What seems far more likely is that President Trump will turn on Kim Jong-un in the same way he's turned on other world leaders who have disappointed him. And then he'll take the car keys away from Pompeo, and he'll give them to John Bolton, and I think we'll be in for the kind of rough period that I describe at the beginning of my book.
Yeah, and how rough, really? The whole point of your book is that we are just a few coincidental events away from nuclear devastation. Is there anything you can say to reassure me that this is all just a figment of your imagination?
I think the best I can do is say that if you look at past nuclear crises and past close calls, it would be far more frightening than this book. We've been way worse off before, and we've made dumber decisions, and we've always managed to muddle through. So if you think this book is frightening, try going through the historical documents.
Jeffrey, thank you very much.
Happy to be your ray of sunshine.
Jeffrey Lewis is the author of the 2020 Commission Report on the North Korean Nuclear Attacks Against the United States. Coming up, 35 years after, the day after.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.